Oh, I have had no luck lately. Wait, lady luck?
Britsky, I got you. I've had so much luck on SpinQuest.com. They have all of my favorite games, slot games, live blackjack craps, and bubble craps. You can even get a $30 coin pack for just 10 bucks.
10 bucks for 30? I'm headed over to SpinQuest.com right now.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Steve, you spent over 30 years helping shape the people that are entrusted with America's security. I mean, some of our most closely guarded secrets. Before we get into your career, I've got a question for you. Could you tell within 5 minutes whether someone would make it in the CIA?
Yes. Is that good enough for you?
Oh, well, we've got to expand on that just a little. How could you tell? What's the telltale signs?
You can tell very quickly if someone's BSing you. You can tell very quickly if someone's being honest, if they're an honest broker. And those are incredibly important. And then another thing that's extremely important to the agency, it's extremely important to most federal agencies, is teamwork. Is this someone who's going to be able to play well in the sandbox? Because some of these sandboxes get really hot, particularly around crisis time. And I need people who are going to be working well together, who have got great critical thinking skills, and can take care of each other. How's that for an expanded answer?
There you go. That's perfect.
Great.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to this week's episode of Game of Crimes with Murph in the Morning. Our guest this week is a 30-year veteran of the Central Intelligence Agency, CIA. You've heard me talk about him repeatedly on here. I have a pet name for him, but I'm not going to embarrass him by telling it while he's on here because he might get mad at me. This guy got promoted all the way up through the ranks, and he retired as the Chief Learning Officer, which I had never heard of, but we're going to find out more about that. And since his retirement, which I think was earlier this year,
correct,
he's now a keynote speaker. He's a leadership advisor. He's a consultant and he's a writer. And we're going to talk about all of those just a little bit more throughout this interview. But ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Steve Hurst to Game of Crime. Steve, welcome to the show, brother.
Thank you, sir. It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
I'm excited to talk to you. I know I've had a few people from the agency on here before. Some field workers, one was in charge of creating disguises for the agency, whose her and her husband were both agency employees. They're very well known.
Great patriots.
Her husband might have written the book that the movie Argo was based on. And so folks, if y'all want to find that out, go back and look up some of the old episodes here at Game of Crimes. But it's how we met is we actually share the same talent agent at United Talent Agency. His name is David Buchalter. I've worked with David for a number of years now. Javier has as well. Just trust this guy more than just about anybody out there in the business world. He called me and he says, hey, I've got a guy that I think would be a good guest for your show, and that's Steve Hurst. And so I went and Googled Steve Hurst. And let me tell you, if you Google it, you're going to be as shocked as I was, because I'm reading about some guy that
I know where this is headed.
I'm reading something about this guy that started porn movies and things like that. And I thought, all right, David, what are you thinking here?
David's branching out.
Being the trained criminal investigator I am, you know, I went a little deeper there, and then I found our guest today. It's not at all what you're going to find if you Google. I don't think the other guy's even still living. I'm not sure. I didn't care enough to venture into it to find out. But so, David, anyway, it's a shout out to you, brother. Thank you so much for the introduction here. And Steve, thank you for joining us on the show.
My pleasure.
So let's just get into your background a little bit. Can you tell us a little bit about where you grew up, what your family dynamics were, what mom and dad did, going to school, did you play sports, that kind of thing?
Sure. I grew up in Northern California, the Bay Area, about an hour north of San Francisco. Well, it was a town then. Now it's a city called Santa Rosa in Sonoma County. I had a remarkably unremarkable childhood. My dad was an Army veteran from Vietnam, and he took advantage of all the things that the government gave to him coming out of Vietnam and went into became a businessman. So my mom was a stay-at-home mom. She was also a teacher from time to time. But I grew up a good Gen Xer with the latchkey kids. You know, you got to be back before the lights on. Other than that, no one really cares where you are. Don't call us. You don't have cell phones. Grew up my high school, again, unremarkable. I wasn't athletically talented enough to be on any of the teams, but I was a scuba diver, love scuba diving. I did some running, a little bit of fencing, and then golfing with my dad. That's the sum total of my athletic prowess. Graduated from high school and then went to college in Southern California, a place called Cal State Northridge. Got my bachelor's degree in, this is going to date me, and I apologize. My degree is in Soviet studies, which, thank God, the Cal State system switched over to foreign policy, which was a little bit easier to market, given that the Soviet Union no longer exists. I then went on to the military. My dad was in the military. His dad was in the military. So I followed in his footsteps. Went through the ROTC program, went to my basic course at scenic Fort Sill, Oklahoma. I don't know if you've ever been there. It is,
I have not.
It's a place. Well, if you're going to be training on artillery, field artillery, you want a flat surface, and it's really flat out there. but I was doing my military training, and the military brought in, they were so excited about this, a brand new computerized simulation system. Uh-huh. Now, this was in like 90, 91, 92. So this was a massive, massive computer on wheels that they had to wheel in. And so they put me up in front of this computer, and they give me basically a battle board, and they say, okay, You're the battery commander. Tell us what you want to do. And I said, okay, first thing I want to do, I want to move the battery to this position. They come back to me and they say, you can't do that. And I said, why can't I do that? They said, you can't do that. What's your second option? I said, I want to do that. I'm physically able to move all of these things. And they say, that's not one of the options we've programmed in. You have to choose something else. And in that moment, I understood that perhaps the military was not the innovative, creative place that I wanted to be. So I went the reserve route, which ultimately, like a lot of folks who you have worked with, we've both worked with, became the National Guard. So I went in the California Army National Guard. Fun fact, I've got terrible timing because my California Army National Guard unit was mobilized twice. Once for the LA riots, and we're talking about the 1992 LA riots, not the most recent ones, and then the 1994 Northridge earthquake. And I say my timing is bad because not only did I get mobilized for both of those, but in 92 during the LA riots, I was actually sent into Compton. Literally, streets are on fire. People are shooting at each other. And I get sent to Compton with my small battery to try to secure this particular intersection. Oh, that was also the first time. Yeah. Oh, yeah. That was also the first time that I came in contact with working with emergency responders and police for the first time on scale, because I had a liaison with the military. And God bless the LAPD, because every morning, and I'm not kidding, they would show up, they would pop open their trunks, and it would be big things of coffee and donuts.
Hey, there you go.
But I don't know what I would have done without that coffee, because I am an absolute avowed coffeeholic. But that was the first time. And then the second time they decided, I guess we did such a good job 2 years ago, they're going to move us literally to ground zero during the 1994 Northridge earthquake. And for those folks who don't remember the Northridge earthquake, a very large earthquake hit a place called Northridge, which is north of Los Angeles. And at ground zero, a three-story apartment building basically pancaked on itself and became two stories. About 50 people died, I think, and most of them were at this ground zero. So we were shipped in there to basically secure the area. Power's out, fires everywhere. And I don't know if you've ever been to a place where there are dead bodies that you can't get to and it's starting to roast in the sun. That was... And by the way, all of the refrigerator and all of the rotting stuff, that was an experience. I'm happy to chat with about either one of those with you.
No, thank you.
That's good. So then I decided, okay, enough of this. I went to grad school. As part of my grad program, I took Russian language because it just fascinated me, having been a Soviet studies major. Went to the Monterey Institute, and then from the Monterey Institute, because I spoke Russian, got recruited into the CIA. And that is sort of how I got to where I got. The interesting story that I probably shouldn't be telling people is that it was kind of a mistake that I actually got to the CIA. I already had a job offer from the Department of Energy where I was going to go, because of my Russian language, I was going to go and actually live in Moscow and be one of the representatives there to help with fissile material and all of that good stuff. But a friend of mine who had not yet gotten a job said, hey, the agency's here. They're doing an information session. Would you mind sitting with me? Sure. So I sat with him. He said, hey, they're doing a session on how to interview. Would you do? Sure. All great to learn. Finally, he says, hey, they're doing interviews. I know you've already got a job, but would you mind going with me? And like, you can do your interview and I can do. I got a job offer almost immediately. That guy did not. The good news is he got a job offer the next year from them.
Yeah, it sounds to me like he'd been recruited to recruit you.
It was just a weird coincidence. Like, I never really intended this to happen. These were the good old days before lots and lots and lots of bureaucracy was built in, where I did my interview. They said, okay, you know, we're probably going to hire you. You hear back from us. I don't hear another word for literally 9 months. So I'm getting ready to go to work for DOE. And because, you know, I'm going to have to live overseas and I got to do all of that stuff. And I get this phone call in April. And I remember I'm in grad school. Hey, congratulations. We'd like to hire you. Can you start next week? Now, whoever it was who was calling from Washington forgot the fact that this was California time. So it's 4 a.m.
Oh, geez.
I was like, what's going on here? So I got myself awake and I said, I actually have to finish grad school. They were a little aggravated at me. They said, okay, how about June 1st? I'm like, perfect. Let's start June 1st.
Wow.
So that's my story.
Well, it sounds like that, you know, the Central Intelligence Agency, that intelligence doesn't apply to every section within any agency.
The agency is an organization of people. Good people.
Absolutely.
Maybe not so good people.
Well, you know, everybody's got their bad apples. You know, we were in Columbia. We had a terrible time with the chief of station, and he was just a jerk. You know, it was unbelievable. But, and it's, you know, as much as I preach against this, it's easy to stereotype an entire agency based on one person's reaction. Since that time, every chief of station that Javier and I have met throughout our careers, even post-DEA, have been fantastic people, easy to talk to, very open, honest. You know, there's things that they can't tell you, and I don't expect them to, you know, but that one down there, boy, Bogota was, he's something. We'd probably do a whole episode just on him.
Or chiefs of station, because I agree with you 100%.
So let me just ask you, when you were growing up, what was it that fascinated you?
What was it that fascinated me?
That would lead to military and eventual government deployment.
So what fascinated me? So I was raised, obviously, in this family that was very supportive of the military. My dad, again, a veteran. So I got to see him in the reserves. I grew up with him in the reserves. For a while, we were stationed overseas, but I was like 2 years old in Germany. So I obviously don't remember those days. Although sadly, there are pictures that continue to exist that I need to destroy. But that sort of infused in me this idea of military service. And I knew that his father, and of course, all I heard about was artillery, 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 king of battle, king of battle, king of battle. So I had to go that way. And the army loves that stuff. The military loves that sort of, you know, you following in the footsteps of your dad. I don't even think I had a choice what branch I was going to go into. It was just sort of a predetermined idea. So the military was big. Both my dad and my mom were politically aware. I'm not going to say they were politically active. I mean, they voted, but they were politically aware, and we had conversations, and they had conversations with their friends a lot about politics. And this was the late 70s, early 80s. So imagine that very big transition between, you know, the Carter years, the Vietnam years, and then moving into suddenly now you've got Ronald Reagan and the reemergence, if you will, of patriotism, and then everything that would become, including, you know, the shining city on the hill. But it was Reagan and Bush were very engaged with the outside world. So I also learned a lot from my parents about, you know, alliances and how important it was to have friends overseas, to make sure that we don't ever get into a position ultimately like we got into Vietnam. So that fascinated me. And then living in California, particularly near the coast, that's how I got into scuba diving. One of my first ideas was I was going to become an oceanic biologist or something, which of course, you know, I love the ocean part, but the biology is actually hard. It's a challenge. So I decided, okay, let's just scuba dive. I don't know if you've ever been, you're a scuba diver? Yes. Yeah. You ever been scuba diving off of the California coast?
No.
I highly recommend it. Yes, it's cold. I get that. But at the same time, it's just so beautiful. And there's all kinds of huge, huge chunks of the California coast that are preserves. They're actually protected. And one of the reasons I went to Monterey was because of the beautiful diving up there, truth be told, and the amazing aquarium that actually supports the Monterey Bay, where it's protected. They can't do anything into that place. So that's why you've got these otters. That's why you've got all the beautiful, beautiful stuff around. So
it's a special place out there.
It is.
It's special in beauty, but it's also special in the little short yellow bus type special. Love you guys from California.
I guess the interview's over now. So
actually, we got a ton of friends out there. I mean, just it's unbelievable. When you were growing up, were you an avid reader?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. I was an avid reader. Like I guess a lot of my friends, mostly science fiction. I loved how words worked. I love why some things worked together, why some stories, some books, some novels were really, really good, and why others just didn't do it for you. And that really lit in me this idea of the power of the word, of the written word, and how to use that, to whatever your means happen to be. So ultimately, when I got into the agency, it was a fairly clear transition to being a DA analyst, director of analysis analyst, writing analysis about all kinds of things. And I joined, actually, I should have said, the CIA, as a chemical and biological weapons analyst, following fairly large countries that I obviously can't talk about. But that then led to me following things like, right after 9/11, you probably remember this, but a lot of people don't. Right after 9/11, there was an anthrax attack in the U.S. Mm-hmm. There were letters sent with anthrax powder to congressmen and senators and a couple of news organizations. And that led to a lot of changes in the way the government responds to chemical and biological threats. Because obviously after 9/11, everyone was very, very focused on, are we prepared if this happens again?
Right. Right. You mentioned some pictures that needed to be destroyed from Germany. I can't let that go without asking, what are those?
I'll just say one word, Lederhosen.
Okay.
And I think we can leave it there. You put a 2 or 3 year old in Lederhosen, and.
Oh, it's cute.
No, it's adorable. It's adorable. But
it's something they use at your wedding or family functions in the future.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
So when you were growing up in your 20s, you know, and now you're going to college, going to the military, all that. What's like the biggest mistake you ever made? If you could go back and do it again, you wouldn't do that.
Biggest mistake I ever made in my 20s. I had no idea, particularly when I went into college, I had no idea what I wanted to do. And I think many, many, many people are in the same place.
Yeah.
I had no idea what I wanted to do. The military, it was a natural progression again from my parents. But I sort of went into it on automatic, and I really had no idea what I wanted to do there either. I didn't have an idea of what I wanted to become. And I was incredibly blessed that towards the end of my undergraduate years, I met a professor who, he was one of the top Sovietologists. because the Soviet Union at the time was in the process of collapsing. Right. And frankly, it was a fascinating time to be studying the Soviet Union. This was during the Gorbachev years where things were starting to break apart. But I met this professor, and he lit a fire in me. And I thank him dearly for that, because he really lit this fire of fascination with how the Soviet Union was working, but how politics works. And I saw where he was coming from, and I saw his progression. And he was also a very deeply charismatic professor who took care of his students. This was a guy who would take his students of age, I want to be very clear, 21 years old. We would go to the pub, and we would sit around, and what we would do, we talk about what was going on in Soviet Union. We talk about what was going on in foreign policy. So yeah, we're having a drink or several, but you're actually continuing to learn. And I became his teaching assistant. And I might get a little broken up here. He came to lunch one day, and this is a guy who's young. This is a guy who used to climb 7 flights to his office numerous times a day, was his kids' soccer coach in California. Everything is soccer for kids. He was coach of all the soccer teams. He would ride his bike 3 miles back and forth to work. He comes in with a cane, and he tells us it's a bone spur. It turns out it was ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease. Okay. And within 6 months, he's paralyzed from the neck down.
Oh my goodness.
I had the deep honor of being his teaching assistant, which ultimately became being a physical assistant. The school bought a van, and we are talking a 70s van, that I would push his wheelchair, I would lock him in the van, and I would drive him to and from home. And the school was, paying me a stipend or whatever it happened to be. I got really great parking spot, like literally on campus. I will say that. But within 6 months, he was paralyzed from the neck down, and continued. He had this passion, so he continued to teach right up until that point. And then it got to the point where he lost control of his vocal cords. And Apple, interestingly enough, Apple actually created a system for him that was tracking his eyes.
Yeah.
But this is revolutionary, and this is way back again in the 90s. So it was crude, but he actually wrote a book, and it's basically, the name of the book is How Will They Know That I'm Dead? And he, deeply religious, a guy of faith, because there were a lot of times where, frankly, someone could simply have pulled a plug and that would have ended his pain, right? But he was a deeply religious man. And so his family came together and helped him. And he lived, this is remarkable. He lived 5 or 6 more years, which usually when it starts that cascade, it's over quickly. But for him, he actually lived 5 or 6 more years before actually passing away. So that all really kicked me in the butt and decided, look, if this amazing hero can do this, you need to get with it. And so that's sort of, okay, let's actually do something here. And that's when I decided maybe teaching, maybe politics, did the military thing, and then I went to grad school. And that's where we are today.
What's his name?
Yeah, I should have said that. His name is Robert Horn, H-O-R-N. And just,
what a motivational person, and what a motivational story.
He, just an unbelievably brave, heroic man, frankly. And he tried to keep it from us for so long, because he didn't want us, because then very few people had heard of ALS. Now, sadly, you hear a lot about it. And thank God, that's a terrible way of putting it. There are heroes out there who happen to be celebrities who use those platforms to talk about this awful, awful thing. And what's sad is we haven't made a whole lot of progress on determining what this thing is. Mm-hmm. But I'll also say he was a big fan of learning through simulations. And so we did a whole lot of simulations where you would convene the Politburo, you'd convene the Security Council, and you'd actually role play these things, and how much more you learn when you actually sit down and put yourself into those roles. And that's something I took forward with me and really tried to bring to the agency even more. And I think I succeeded.
Wow, that's really cool. I'm getting young people at that age to put themselves in someone else's shoes to figure out how they would react.
It was a lot of fun. Yes, you are. I hear what you're saying.
Well, you know, and it's encouraging too to hear that the man had his standards and he continued to live up to those standards, even through, I mean, talk about diversity. Wow.
And the fact that he didn't tell us, frankly, he then had to tell us because I'm his teaching assistant. I'm helping him get around, and we're going from a slight cane with a slight limp to now he can't walk, to now he can't move his legs. Like, at some point you have to be honest. And he said, I didn't want to get anyone concerned. No one knows a lot about this thing. I'd appreciate it, you know, if you would continue to stay on as my teaching assistant. And myself and another guy, we helped him out, and it was an honor.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the only word I can come up with. It was an honor being there for him, and watching as, I mean, what unbelievable heroics. So anyway, that was like, what the hell are you doing with your life, Steve? My God, yeah. this man has got everything to give, and you're, I wasn't blowing it away, but at the same time, I wasn't taking advantage of it. So that's when I decided it's time.
What an exceptional mentor to have.
Yes.
So, all right, let's get to your CIA. When you joined CIA, did your friends, I mean, the one friend knew what you were doing, but could you tell your friends what you were doing? I got a job at the CIA.
Right. So when you get hired into the CIA, there's generally a conversation about where is the best fit for you. Sometimes they just tell you. Sometimes there's a conversation because, hey, you know, you've been overseas, you speak a foreign language. Maybe you would also be good in the DO, the director of operations. Those are the folks that do, you know, the spying that you see in most of the movies. Or you know, we've got a lot of directorates. It's the director of support that does the facilities. Maybe you could help us actually run the buildings, et cetera, et cetera. So there's usually a conversation, and I ultimately, it just made absolute sense for me to go into the DA, and I did. And the DA, generally, we are overt employees, which means if asked, we are legally required to tell you we work for the federal government. And then if you say, I work for the federal government, people will say, okay, where? I work for the CIA, full stop. You don't say anything else. Which can be because the American citizens, if someone is an American citizen and they ask you, we've got to tell you if you're overt. I was not covert, so people knew. But I also was not out there telling everybody. It's not one of these things I would wave my hand. And when you're living in Washington, D.C., you know, working for the CIA or working for DEA or the FBI may be like really exciting. In other parts of the country, Washington, D.C., it's like, oh, yeah, here, another gov, another Fed, yeah. Another Fed. Now, seriously, you know, it's another Fed. All right, whatever. Join the group. So people just generally didn't ask. When you would say, I work for the federal government, they'd be like, okay.
You know, it's funny, too, because we were stationed in D.C. twice, and so we lived out in Ashburn.
Ah, yeah.
In Loudoun County, it was known as the Fed Ghetto.
When was that?
First time we got there 3 weeks before 9/11. And then we were there for 5 years. And then I got promoted up to SES in, let's see, when was I? 2009. I think it's 2009. So, and we moved right back in the same neighborhood. We moved down two doors from where we lived previously. So we had the same next door neighbor. They're just now on the other side of us, who are still some of our best friends.
What did you call it? The Fed?
Fed Ghetto.
Fed Ghetto. It's so true. And yet, you saw the change to Ashburn and Loudoun County in just those few years. It's gotten even bigger.
Yeah.
And it's just growing and growing and growing as I think the, you know, people are trying to move away from the city and the burbs.
Yeah. Did your mom and dad know what you actually did to the CIA?
They knew I worked at the CIA. My mom, God bless my mom. She watched too many movies, but she decided that she decided that she was going to come up with a code word. So she would say, Steve works for the post office. The post office. And so, like, that would be the family joke. Oh, Steve, you work for the post office. Yeah, I'm going back to the post office. Okay, Mom. Thanks. But they knew where I worked, and they knew generally that I was a chemical and biological weapons analyst. That's about all that they knew. And, you know, you've talked a lot, and I appreciate the fact that you've done this. You've talked a lot on your podcasts about families and what they go through. Yes. And this was really the first time, because, you know, I served overseas. I served in numerous crisis areas, including hot war zones. I think I've served in just about every war zone since the Bosnia conflict. So that's way back, right? And you can't tell them where you're going. You can't tell them what you're doing, and you're confident, you're comfortable, you know, you're safe, you know, you're secure. They don't know where you are. Mm-hmm. And I didn't really understand what a burden that is on our families until I had to deal with that with my parents. And my mom would get distraught because it'd be like, hey, you know, I'm just going overseas for a couple of months. I'll be back. You know, I'll write you letters. Whatever. But they knew. They're not dumb. They know what you work. They know you've been through this before. And so they would be on their edge waiting for you to get back simply so that they know you're okay. And we all go through this. You've been through this. And it's something that we don't really think about with our loved ones, the effects that it has on them.
Hey, everybody. Lady Luck here. And we're celebrating America's 250th birthday. Now, all summer long, I'm going to be celebrating by playing on SpinQuest.com, which is an American-owned social casino. It obviously features over 1,000 slot games and live blackjack, live craps, live bubble craps. Head on over to SpinQuest.com. Get yourself a $30 coin pack for just 10 bucks.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
You know, I think my parents understood that they raised an idiot who loved adrenaline type events. But when we transferred from Miami to Bogota, Colombia, my wife's parents, that's the ones that we worried more about them. I think my dad understood that, you know, I'm going to do what I want to do, or I don't mean to sound like that. I'm going to do what I think is the right thing to do, I guess would be a better way to put it. And, but then we brought her mom down for a visit once we lived there. And she fell in love with the place. She saw how nice it was. It's not, you know, only Colombians I ever met before I moved there were the ones I put in jail for trafficking and drugs. Again, you stereotype the whole country.
Yeah, right. Right. It's beautiful. No, it's actually beautiful.
It is. Yeah. It really is. So when you join the CIA, is there a training academy that you have to go through, or how do they train you into what they want you to do?
Right. So they determine working with them, where you're going to work and what your career is going to start off. And one thing I will say, and this will be a theme throughout the rest of our conversation, is the agency has always viewed itself as a small agency, regardless of its actual size. It's always had this idea that it's a small agency. And what that has made is a very agile, flexible organization. And I say that because I am amazed at how many of my peers and former colleagues were able to move around within the organization. So just because you say you hire in as, let's say, a DA officer, many of my colleagues started off in the DO and came over to the DA, or started in the DA, went over to the DO. We move around fairly fluidly. And I think what that makes is a much stronger organization, because you're able to bring those talents and skills. And ultimately, it becomes a matter of who is the best person, who are the best people for the mission and the job we have now. And the agency, God bless it, has always been great at getting the thing done. Okay, we've got challenge. You know, you brought up Argo. We've got a challenge. We got to figure this thing out. We got to get through it. Who are the best people to bring into the conversation? Let's bring them in and let's do it. So to get back to your question, you hire in, Okay, so I'm going to be a DA officer following chemical and biological weapons, all right? So first thing they're going to do is they're going to put you through some very basic training. Obviously, there's you know, I'll call it CIA 101. Welcome to the agency. Here's where the food court is or the cafeteria. Here's what your benefits are. Here's how generally a career is going to move through. This is how you get your badges. This is how you do all those things that are required administratively for someone who's going to be working for the CIA. Right. And those, I think wisely, at least when I was there, and by the way, everything I say is when I was there, because things change, we're everybody together. It's an EOD class that happens to be everybody who's coming on board in that particular week. So I had plenty of DO people in my class. I had plenty of DS, directorate of support folks in there, and we're all new. But it's like, it's the first actual opportunity for you to network with other folks. And I still am friends with some of the people that I met there. So that's the Agency 101. And then they shipped you back and you got to watch and observe and learn from mentors. And here's another shout out to the agency. Very, very, very strong culture of mentorship, right? And I had, God bless this guy, I had an old school mentor who, I mean, this is like somebody out of a movie. He literally walked me around to all of the different parts of the organization that I needed to know, basically helping me grow my network. He drove me to all of the other organizations, the NSAs, the DIAs, drove me to the Pentagon so I could physically meet all of my counterparts, gave me a Rolodex, a literal Rolodex. Again, this is the mid-90s.
Yeah.
And a great, great guy. But he would then sit down with me and say, okay, I'm writing this particular piece. It's not going to be for the president, but it's like a technical piece. So we're going to put it here. This is how you do it. This is Leia. So I'm observing. I'm watching. And then after probably a couple of months, they then send you to basically your directorate-specific training, the first tranche. And this is, how do you write in DA style? That's what we call it, DA style. I don't know if you've seen any of the redacted stuff, the PDBs, or any of the many, many, many documents that have been declassified. But DA style is extremely concise. It is painfully concise. It's also painfully simple, and every word counts, which again is fascinating to watch, but it's not how people speak. It's an analytic piece. And the thinking there is, and as you know, and we'll probably talk, I'm sure we'll talk about this. I was a PDB briefer. You only have a set period of time with whoever your policymaker happens to be. You don't have time to screw around. So you need to say, sir or ma'am, this is what's happening. This is what we think. It's based on this. Here are some of the possible outcomes. Here are some of the possible, not solutions, because we don't go there, but that's it. And usually it's a page or two. That's it. So they've got to really break you of your academic writing style where it's, here's my 83rd footnote on page one. Here's the direct quotes. You don't have time or space. Mm-hmm. In fact, one of the funny things that I learned was white space matters. White space matters. So like, you've got to have white space balanced on the text, because you need to like be leading the very technical information very quickly and very simply. So yeah, you go through your directorate specific first line training, then they ship you back, and you have 2, 3, 4 years. I don't know what it is today. For me, it was 3 years, which is called a probationary period. And that's for you to determine whether you want to stay there, but more for them to determine, is this working out? Do you have what it takes? And then once you get through the probationary period, then they would send you to sort of the next level of training, which is your particular subject matter. You had to brief seniors, how to do all of these great things to take your skill and your craft to the next level.
Wow. Can you say where the training locations are and how long they last, or is that classified?
It's classified, but I will tell you that a lot of the training obviously takes place at headquarters, because that's where, you know, the majority of the folks are. As far as the training goes, so The EOD thing that I took was just like a week. And then the training, the other training, it really depends. The first line training now for the directorate of analysis, I think is almost 6 months. It's fairly intense, but they really have to get you into that brain pattern of how to do the job, right? So it's like a semester at school. And then the rest of them are, it depends. You can take a week long class. You can take a day long seminar. I went on to teach leadership, and I taught everything from a 1 day seminar to, a 6 month, class that wasn't six full months, but it was, every couple of days, every other week kind of a deal across 6 months to 2 weeks, two full week courses. But it really depended on what we're teaching you. And you've had some amazing guests. A lot of those guests had to learn their craft, some very particular crafts at the agency, because who else does some of that stuff, right?
Right, right. You know, we hear about, I think it's pretty common knowledge about their facility down towards Williamsburg, Virginia. You know, it's depicted in movies, and you never know what's true and what's not true.
I'm going to not confirm or deny anything.
Gotcha. And you mentioned the president's daily briefing, the PDB. Did you ever get to brief the president?
I got to brief the president once, and that was a bit of a fluke. So the way PDB briefing works is you're a briefer, and you are assigned to a particular principal, right? And I should note here that you're not going to hear me giving you any names, because it is extremely important that the briefer and the person being briefed are able to maintain that relationship and that trust that's been built. So it's sort of a little bit of a cone of silence, because you can't really talk about the things that were talked about. Because I will tell you, I had some incredibly intense conversations with the people I briefed. But I'm also not going to tell you who those people were, because it's sort of like, the confessional, if you will, that sort of professional courtesy. So by rule, I can't tell you who. I can tell you what the organization was. So for example, I was a regular briefer for the Secretary of Homeland Security. I was a regular briefer for the Secretary of Agriculture. I was a regular briefer for the Secretary of Health and Human Services. And I was a regular briefer for the Director of FEMA, right? Now, remember, I was brought on as a briefer right after the anthrax attack during 9/11. So that's why it was HHS. That's why it was agriculture. And that's why it was FEMA, because those are the organizations that would be in charge of a domestic response. And they were all very, very involved in the response to the anthrax, obviously, attack. I did numerous briefings, for example, at the White House, and you would run into the president, you'd run into the vice president, you'd be in the situation room. And I did get to brief the president once. That was a blast. I also got to brief, the Secretary of Defense, in the Pentagon after 9/11, right after 9/11. That was something else. And we can talk about that later if you'd like, but I got to brief him numerous times. And it was, the building, you could still smell the fuel in the air. And they were busy trying to fix it. And the security was just crazy, but that was a time.
Absolutely. It was, we had just moved to DC, Ashburn, and we were living there at that time. I was in special operations with DEA. The office was out in Lorton. The building, you know, it's a surreptitious facility, but we were right across the street. It's no longer there. It's right across the street from the fuel farm for National Airport. And we're thinking, you know, the planes go down, the boss calls everybody in, and, you know, we got all these agents from all these different agencies, and he briefs everybody on what's going on. He said, we're going to set up security around the building here. How many of you have weapons? Now, these are 1811 gun-toting law enforcement professionals, and I think 8 of us had guns on us out of probably 60 or 80 agents in the building.
Oh, wow.
But then you go out there and you stay, and of course the next day everybody has a weapon, but you go out there and you're looking at the fuel farm across the street and it's like, you know, if a plane hits that, we're vaporized. We're not even going to know it. It seemed kind of ridiculous at the time, but it was unprecedented. You know, we'd never been attacked like that. So
yeah,
it's like people didn't really know how to respond, not on an international level, not our military, so forth, but you know, just on basic worker bee level. What do you do? Remember, I mean, you were there, DC almost shut down.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting because I was actually overseas on 9/11. Because of my chemical and biological weapons background, I was often supporting the military doing, the military does a lot of these, huge sort of simulations, and they do huge force exercises. Some of them are all force, some of them are just partially, but they would bring me often over to help with running the actual simulation, which again I talked about with my professor at undergraduate who lit this fire in me about simulations. I was always volunteering because it's fascinating to me what you can get out of this. So I was overseas on 9/11. And I was with two other folks, and it was 12 on, 24 off, and I had just come off of my shift. I get in bed, I wake up the next morning, and I turn on the news because I'm one of these freaks that I need to just have the TV on in the background. I need the noise. I guess I'm a little extroverted, and I need the noise in the background, even though I'm not watching it. Turn it on, and I watch as an airplane flies into the Twin Towers. Now I'm thinking to myself, I've just woken up, I haven't had coffee yet. I'm thinking it's a movie, all right. So I take my shower, I get ready, I do all the things. I'm getting ready to eat out, and I see that it's still the same scene. And the thought that goes through my head is, this is a really bad movie, right?
Yeah.
So I turn the channel, and it's the same thing. But now it's a German channel because I had an American channel on. And anyway, you go through this and it hits you. This is not a movie. This is what happens. And I'll tell you, the base I was at in Germany, when I had left the night before, it was a bunch of contractors, German and American contractors who were thorough. They were doing their job, but you know, that was it. That was the level of security. When I went back, there were three lines of security.
Wow.
German police in full riot gear, which I don't know if you've ever seen German police in full riot gear. That is some frightening stuff. Behind were U.S. military in their combat gear. And then these poor, terrified contractors who had been there the night before, like terrified, not even knowing what to do. So I walk onto this base. I've got my credentials. I get onto the base. As I'm walking towards the base, I see all these flowers, like thousands of flowers and candles. And Germans had just started to put these candles and these flowers. Like, this is already happening. This is probably an hour or two, no, it's probably a couple of hours after 9/11 has happened, and already you're starting to see this stuff. And those flowers just continue to grow and grow, and the candles and American flags everywhere, right? Mm-hmm. So like a lot of people, I was in Europe. What a lot of people don't know is the U.S. airport shut down completely. So did European airports. Frankfurt shut down. All German airports shut down. Airspace over all European countries shut down, which meant I was now stuck in Germany. But the military that I was supporting had vaporized. They were off because now they were being put on high alert. They needed to get back to their units. So I'm stuck in Germany. I can't get back. My directions were basically just to lay low. But I'm clearly an American. I've got a military haircut. People kept coming up to me. Germans kept coming up to me, and it was like just so touching. People kept trying to buy me drinks and buy me food, and like it was one of these things where you just wanted to be left alone. Like, stop! I want to be able to process this. So finally, I got back to the U.S. And then almost immediately was told, "Congratulations! Now you're going to be briefing the PDB," and that's how that played out.
Woohoo!
Yeah. Yes.
So we're going to jump around just a little bit, just because it kind of it fits within the time frame here, everybody. So you eventually worked your way all the way up to the chief learning officer for the Central Intelligence Agency. And, you know, in the Reader's Digest version, tell us what that is.
Because you're making a huge jump from my first job to my last job.
But we're going to fill in the middle here in a little bit.
Okay. So chief learning officer is exactly what the words say. That is the person who is responsible for training and learning across all of the agency. So I want you to think about everything the agency does. And some of the things you think it does, whether it does that or not, you have one person who is responsible for training and learning across the agency. And that's things like the effectiveness of training and learning. Are we using the best tools to convey that learning? Are we making sure that we're holding ourselves to academic and intellectual standards, that we're not just trying to check boxes? So you have one person whose job it is to make sure that the training and learning that's happening across the agency, everything from, frankly, secretarial work and facilities, plumbing and wiring, all the way to deep spycraft. Everything the agency does, all of those things, you have one person who has to make sure that all of those things are up to standard and are actually doing what we need them to do. And I really, as I told you, working with my mentor in undergrad, I really had a passion for teaching and learning. And that was a job that pretty much from my 10th year at the agency, I always thought I would like that job before I retire. Lo and behold, that was the job I got right before I retired.
Be careful what you ask for, right?
Correct. At the same time, I'm deeply honored that I was chosen for that position. I think we accomplished some amazing things in that period because we have things like, AI, which I know we're going to start talking about, and how that affects adult learning. But also we have incredible amounts of resource constraints and frankly, budget cuts. You know, I lived through the post 9/11 years where money was flowing through to most of the federal government, including the intelligence community. And it was, you know, we need to do these things. Don't worry about money. We'll get it done. We need to downsize the federal government. We need to downsize every part of the operation. So here we're going to do, you know, you need to lose this. You need to lose that. That one person has to look across all of the agency to make sure that that's happening. So a little bit of infrastructure. I told you that each of the directorates have got their own training. Well, they have their own schoolhouses, right? So the DO has got its schoolhouse. The DA has got its schoolhouse. The DS has got its schoolhouse. And all of those schoolhouses are responsible for their own tradecraft, right? But above all of that, excuse me, is what's called the learning enterprise. And that's where the chief learning officer basically is an umbrella, making sure that everybody is abiding by the standards, making sure that everybody is abiding by the sort of agreements that we've made across the organization. And in fact, I think you can see behind me, this is all of the different schoolhouses. When I left, they gave me this lovely plaque. But those are the challenge coins from all of the schoolhouses for serving that particular capacity. But as I also said, the agency is a remarkable place because people work across those boundaries. So the schoolhouses are constantly working with each other on, oh, hey, you're doing something really interesting there. We'd love to bring that into our schoolhouse. Can we work with you? And I got to tell you, in my 3 years of serving as the deputy chief learning officer and then the chief learning officer, and then my 3 years serving as a leadership instructor, I never once saw anybody play badly in the sandbox. Everybody was just, hey, we'd love to learn from you. We'd like to share this with you. It's a really cooperative organization because, again, it's got this idea that it's a small organization and we're all in this together. And I really, frankly, love that.
This sounds like a huge responsibility. You're not making all the decisions. You're going to each of the directorates and saying, what is it you need? What is it you want to update? That kind of thing. I'm guessing. How much input do you actually get to have on that?
A lot. So there are, you know, there are rules, there are agency rules, there are regulations. And by regulation, the chief learning officer is responsible to report things to the director and the seventh floor, the C-suite of the agency. He or she is responsible for standards. I mean, these are things that are in regulation. So I have that authority. I had that authority. But at the same time, the only way you can really bring all of these very disparate organizations together is to not really be you know, yielding, sort of wielding that cudgel, but is actually to be working together. So that was the way I brought people together. It's like, look, it's our mutual interest, particularly with these resource constraints and cuts. We need to work together. Here are the standards. And I would just offer, for example, you know, we have to think about the world of AI in learning. Specifically in learning. Here are some thoughts that I have on what those standards should be. Let's have a conversation, rigorous conversation, sometimes a very rigorous conversation. But then you come back and you say, okay, let's come together. Let's agree as a group, and then let's move forward. So I had the authority, and once or twice I had to pull the authority. But most of the time, it's fairly clear what's best for learning in an organization. And that's sort of where we got to where we did. Does that answer your question?
It does. And I think you teach leadership, so I'm not trying to tell you what to say, but I mean, one of the tenets of leadership is if you can get the people to buy into the idea, you got a lot greater chance of success than pulling out the badge and says, I'm the director. This is what we're doing.
Correct. When you bring people together as a team, and that's always what I've tried to do across my career. When you bring people together as a team and you get people to buy into your mission and your vision, when your mission and your vision becomes their mission and their vision, it's amazing what people can do. Utterly amazing what people can do. And I am just absolutely floored by some of the things that I saw happen when you can make those things work. But teamwork is all about teamwork. It can be the CIA, it can be DEA, it can be FBI. It's always about teamwork and having your folks back.
Well, that you segue right into the next question. What lesson from the CIA training would every police academy in the United States benefit from?
Wow. So I think that the lesson most people can learn is, I would say teamwork, but again, most police academies are going to teach teamwork the same way. We really also have a deep spirit of creativity and innovation. And that's one of the things that really attracted me to the agency. And I think what I would say, my answer is the sheer absolute importance of critical thinking as a separate thing, right? So it's not just, you know, oh, it's important to have critical thinkers, but we're gonna train you on AI or AI, or we're gonna train you how to shoot this thing, or we're gonna train you how to make this thing. You have to actually help people build their critical thinking skills so that in the moment of crisis, when you're confronted with whatever it happens to be in a police capacity, it's, you know, you're confronting an armed assault or something like that. You're a fire, you know, a fire rescue. Literally a fire or somebody is wounded in front of you. Are they ready? Are they prepared for that critical thinking in that moment? And that's one of the things that I think the agency has done really well is preparing people, not necessarily for the specific thing, because we all do lots of training. We all do lots of training. Let's go out on the range. Let's shoot. Let's make sure, you know, the things we do by rote over and over again so that it becomes muscle memory. And that's deeply important. But at the same time, things happen that pull you out of that memory. Unique things that are going to throw you for a loop. Are you ready to make that call in the moment? And the best way to get you there, and this is a lesson I would say I got from the agency, but I also got from being the chief learning officer, is while you're doing all the other things and you're thinking about all the other skills, are you thinking about critical thinking as its own separate skill to sharpen? Because the best people, the biggest heroes we have are the ones that have had critical thinking skills. Just go look. I don't know if I'm sure you have. If you've ever read some of the Medal of Honor accommodations, mm-hmm. My gosh, every single one of those pretty much is a case study on the importance of critical thinking. Every single one of them. And so that's what I would say.
Well, and you're, I mean, you say it very well. I say it a lot simpler that, you know, you can tell the people that are the ones that we look up to, especially in DEA throughout my career, were the ones that had that ability to have the critical thinking. They could, it's not that they're looking into the future, but they're planning in the future, the what if scenarios. And, you know, you hear them come in and they'll have a talk with you and talk about whatever the new objective is. And you're thinking, why didn't I think of that? But it's something that can be learned. You just like you said, you have to kind of train your mind, get a mentor to teach you how to do that, get a chief learning officer that promotes that throughout the agency. It works. It works. I mean, and that's how you avoid disaster down the road.
100%. And it's not actually not hard. We talked earlier about, you know, social media. And the one thing I'm trying to do on my very little social media is this idea of sharpening critical thinking skills isn't hard. Ultimately, critical thinking is about challenging your thinking. That's ultimately what it is, right? Now, there's a whole bunch of things that go into it, but I've been posting these 5-minute drills, I call them. It's just about challenging your assumptions. So one of the critical thinking 5-minute drills that I've posted is when you have a reaction to something, take a breath. For example, the example I use, I think, is an email. You get an email from your boss that makes you really angry and you immediately jump to a conclusion about why your boss sent you that. Take a breath and think about 2 or 3 additional reasons why your boss may have sent you that email other than, my God, my boss is a real jerk. All right. All that does is it slows you down, makes your brain think about it, pulls back your brain as opposed to the emotions. And it's not hard. It's 5 minutes. It's all the kinds of things you can do. And all I'm saying to folks is all those other skills are deathly important. They are extremely important. But at the same time, are you also taking the time to help your workforce think about the things they're thinking about? And I put it that way. And we're going to talk about AI. I know we are. But I keep talking about the importance of the human in the system. AI is extremely important. I am a huge fan with lots of caveats, but I am also constantly saying, yes, and are you preparing your people to use these tools, to question these tools, to use their critical thinking skills? So could not agree with you more.
Yep. And to see these, is that on your LinkedIn site?
It is. They are on my LinkedIn site. I think I'm about to post the 5th one a little bit later today, and then I'll probably repost all 5 of them. I've had a lot of great conversations with people on LinkedIn and people forwarding them. I'll be honest, I created them with AI, right? But I tried to keep them very simple, and I think these are not hard. Again, it's within a 5-minute drill. So all I'm asking, but the more you do it, the more you challenge yourself, the more you're thinking in terms of, okay, now I'm actually in this position. I'm out on the line. I'm a beat cop, and suddenly I'm confronted with this thing that I'm not used to because of my brain is sharp. I've been thinking about these things. I can challenge myself in the moment. I can actually react the way I need to react. And when you talk to people, and you've talked to a lot of heroes, right? Most of the people you've interviewed, and frankly, I would say you, most of the things you've confronted, there have been some incredible, like, curveballs that have been thrown at you. Incredible curveballs. I would wager how you reacted to those curveballs really made you the hero and perhaps the celebrity that you are today, right? Because those are the things that are unique to your particular situation, but you knew how to react in the moment.
Well, when it was danger, I was usually curled up in a fetal position and cried for my mom.
Been there with you.
Thank you for saying that. It's certainly don't consider myself a hero or a celebrity, either one. But folks, listen, you know, I usually don't do this until the end of episode 2, but check Steve out here on LinkedIn. It's under Steve Hirsch, H-I-R-S-C-H. His first name is just like mine. It's actually Steven with a P-H, but we go by Steve.
Yeah.
Check that out and look these, especially if you're interested in learning more about leadership, which we all should be. It's one thing we've tried to teach our children, and we're trying to teach our grandchildren now, is choose to be a leader, not a follower. You have to do some following to learn. You need those real life experiences. But anyway, go over to LinkedIn there and check Steve out in these little 5-minute clips. And who knows, I'm telling you now, I will be doing that. You never stop learning.
And I don't think the other Steve Hirsch has got a LinkedIn page, so no one needs to be worried about the porn king of LA or whatever the heck he was.
Well, listen, you guys that are listening to this on audio, see, you need to go over to YouTube and subscribe to Game of Crimes here so you can see what this Steve Hirsch looks like, so right. That when you do Google him, you'll know what he looks like, right?
Exactly.
Steve, listen, we've been going a little over an hour now. I love these conversations because the time just flies by. It kills me that I keep cutting them off, but I want to be considerate of your time. But Steve has agreed to come back tomorrow for part two, so I'm encouraging you folks to come back tomorrow. Truly appreciate you coming back every week to support the Game of Crimes. Could not do any of this without you. If you haven't checked us out yet on Game of Crimes, we have a Game of Crimes Patreon channel. It's patreon.com/Game of Crimes. Come over and look at some of the serious and silly stuff that we do over there. Got some fantastic people as followers over there that are true family members of the Game of Crimes. In the meantime, everybody stay safe out there. We'll see y'all tomorrow.
Thanks a lot.
What's going on, everyone? It's Bluff here. And you know what's more American than America's 250th birthday? Supporting American-owned companies like SpinQuest, America's number one social casino with over 1,000 games like Live Dealer Blackjack and Craps. They're offering new users a $30 coin package for just $10. Go to SpinQuest.com and sign up today.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.